This episode is brought to you by Castor and Pollux, maker of America's number one organic pet food, Organix. Look for their newest line, Pristine, the only complete line of pet food made with responsibly sourced ingredients. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org/pets.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Hey, hey, you're listening to Eat Your Words on Heritage Radio Network, and I'm your host, Kathy Irway. It's about that time of year where you might replace summer beach reading during the last few months with something like work or textbooks. Or if you're craving a good narrative read, maybe something that has a little bit more teeth to it. So I highly recommend a book that is enormously entertaining, yet also bravely dark, and it's a true story. By my author that I'm joined with today. So she has just written a memoir called Comfort Food Diaries, My Quest for the Perfect Dish to Mend a Broken Heart. And it is none other than Emily Nunn, who is joined by phone. Hi, Emily. How are you?
Hi, I'm good. How are you?
Thank you so much. I'm doing great. And thank you for this wonderful, wonderful read. I am totally engrossed, just like from the first few pages. I was totally engrossed from the first few pages, and it's a marvelous book. And I have to say, you have been getting, it comes out Tuesday, so
it does.
We're still in the sneak preview phase. But you've been getting comparisons to the biting humor of David Sedaris, the emotional honesty of Cheryl Strayed, and in the tradition of Elizabeth Gilbert and Ruth Reichel. So those are, you know, pretty good company. What do you make of all this?
Well, that's a good question. I'm a little overwhelmed right now, actually, because I'm under-socialized. I've been sort of in isolation for 3 years.
While writing this?
Yeah. I'm overwhelmed. I mean, I've been living out, you know, in rural farmland, and now trying to get back into, you know, being a human being. So if I start yelling or I don't stop talking, just tell me to stop. I mean, I see people in the grocery store and they ask me, you know, do you know how much hamburger is? And I'll, you know, talk for 3 hours about it. It's really embarrassing.
That's so funny. But
I'm overwhelmed.
That's so exciting. Yeah, congratulations. I think it should be
a very exciting
launch. But, you know, you've written for decades about food in New York and in Chicago. So you've been a 10-year contributor for The New Yorker, or staff writer, that is,
right,
where you created the Tables for Two column, the magazine's restaurant column. You've also been a staff reporter for the Chicago Tribune as the food and features reporter. So, So lots of time in and around food writing, and you're now still a freelance food writer. But what do you think? Did you ever imagine that you'd write a memoir that had to do with food?
Yeah. No, never. I mean, I went from the New Yorker magazine, and by the way, I co-created Tables for Two.
Okay.
I mean, I don't want to take complete credit for that. It was a lot of fun.
Mm-hmm.
But I left the New Yorker for the Chicago Tribune because they said, you know, we want to make you a full-time writer. And at the New Yorker, a lot of us were editors, and our dream was to get published more. And I was doing freelance for Vogue and Elle and some other magazines. And the Tribune came along out of nowhere about a year after September 11th and offered me a full-time writing job. And it was like an offer that I couldn't refuse.
Mm-hmm.
And it was also trial by fire. I went from, you know, mostly editing into being a daily deadline reporter. And now I can't remember what your question was.
Oh, no problem. So all this, you know, reporting, journalism, and then all of a sudden food narrative memoir. It's a different genre.
It is. And even though, you know, the kind of reporting that I did at the Tribune, I did a lot of features reporting. I followed a lot of people around at their jobs, and I did a lot of process reporting. And food was what I did at the beginning. And then towards the end, when they started laying people off, I asked to be switched from regular features, and I had been a food columnist, restaurant columnist, to actually doing good eating, which was writing about cooking and testing recipes. And so my last time, you know, last year and a half there was in the test kitchen, writing about, interviewing chefs too. And it was narrative, but it wasn't about me. And that, believe it or not, I mean, I know a lot of people would jump at the opportunity to write about themselves, but it was really difficult for me. The project sort of for me had to happen, but it wasn't a natural thing for me to talk about myself the same way it's not natural for me to be talking to you on the radio.
But you write
totally different kind of writing.
Yeah. And it seems, I mean, I feel very fortunate to have interviewed a lot of writers in what I can tell is it looks like a growing genre of narrative food memoirs that have come about. So, but go ahead.
No, I'll continue. Like I said, I'll interrupt you, and then I'll start talking about something completely different. So I want to try to have some sort of coherent.
No problem. No, but I'm really I'm intrigued to learn that this is not something that was premeditated too much on your part, but you do so confidently.
Not at all. I mean, I started when I was feeling super sarcastic about my life before it sort of imploded. I had this idea for a book called The Dysfunctional Family Cookbook.
And,
it was, I forgot about it. And then I pulled out some notes later and, it had recipes in it like sly non-alcoholic punch with vodka, and sorts of things that, really dark that I thought were just hilarious.
Yeah.
Nobody else thought it was funny in the least. So, I had ideas that I would do a larger writing project, but not a memoir ever.
Right.
And, this obviously the book couldn't have come about if a lot of really horrible things hadn't happened. One tragedy and then I guess what most people would consider a series of very, very inconvenient incidents, and they kind of just kept coming. And it kind of happened naturally, the book.
Yeah. And I got to, say, this is really not your fluffy, foodie memoir read. You really encounter all the dark spaces that you can. So just to kind of acquaint listeners with the major plot lines that occur, would it be okay if I read a little tidbit from the intro?
Absolutely. Better you than
me. Okay. Well, it's so beautifully written. I hope I read it. Okay.
Thank you.
So you write, after the breakup, as my life started to spark and smell like smoke, I poured alcohol on it and watched it burst into blazes as if I were preparing Cherry's Jubilee for a crowd. Sometimes only a flaming dish can serve as the proper ending to a dramatic meal. One night I drank several glasses of Sauvignon Blanc and in a fit of uncensored self-pity broadcast the details of my wrecked life on Facebook for the unsolicited elucidation of around 350 so-called friends. Pouring out my heart, I wept a bit while I typed, pausing to gaze to my floor-to-ceiling windows at Lake Michigan. It went something like this. My brother's funeral was 3 weeks ago, and my fiancé just broke up with me. I have almost no money, no job, no home, no car, no child to pick up after school, no dog to feed, no one to care for. I am cold and alone. It was actually a lot more detailed than that, but a lot more embarrassingly melodramatic, but I deleted it, and I don't remember all of it, nor do I ever wish to. Okay. So the morning after my pathetic post, I swallowed my slightly hungover dread and logged on to receive a remarkable surprise. Instead of punishment for my honesty, I had been rewarded with kindness. The little Facebook comment button displayed a big number, but it was not the sign of virtual scolding. It turned out to be a bright flag signaling that people from all around the country were willing to come down to the river with me, so to speak, so I wouldn't be alone. Wow. So this is at the same time very familiar and a very extreme occurrence. So because I think that everyone has seen people pour out their heart to their friends on Facebook when they're in need.
Sure. And I can spot those people, like raccoons on the side of the road, as Jerry Seinfeld used to say. I mean, I know I can. Having done that, and again, that was kind of a mild version of what I read on Facebook, and I had family members say, "Emily, you might want to take that down. It could keep you from getting a job in the future." And I was like a job is even, you know, that's the last of my worries. I took it down, you know, because I think it made, you know, people in my family uncomfortable. But, you know, it was pretty detailed. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I had been drinking, of all things, Sauvignon Blanc. And the next day, though, was just unbelievable. I mean, it was, you know, and I don't know if people who do what I did get that kind of reaction. I mean, there were hundreds of remarks and comments. Because I find now that, you know, lots of people, when they have that kind of on, you know, in the ether, but crisis, public nervous breakdown, they kind of get scolded. It's become, I think, you know, not the thing to do. And you get unfriended a lot. That didn't happen to me, and I don't know why. I don't know why they didn't unfriend me, but they you know, people came out and actually gave me the idea for the book.
The Comfort Food Diaries. So you got so many wonderful responses, and it sounds like thanks to so many of your friends being foodies themselves, or
maybe
professional foodies, and just people who loved food, a lot of the offers and invitations you got were around, let's go, let me make something for you.
Exactly.
Let's cook together.
It was amazing.
Yeah, you say that Facebook kind of saved your life. I think that's a wonderful sort of, you know, we hear a lot about the internet destroying lives, but it seems like the opposite in this case.
Right. Well, I've done both. you know, it is, like most people, you know, I've sent plenty of emails where I, you know, I should have, you know, put them in the draft folder. But in this instance, yeah, it was a really beautiful thing. I mean, I really can safely say that Facebook saved me. I can't hit that note hard enough. And, you know, a lot has changed on Facebook in, you know, in the years since this happened. But, you know, it still strikes me as kind of an amazing thing that we're able to communicate that way and come together and have a community. I mean, I was struck by the idea that while I was typing and weeping, you know, in the dark, that there were other people all around the country, you know, at their computer terminals, and they were being together with me over food, which ended up being the premise of the book.
Mm-hmm. And your honesty also sparked more honest responses from folks, and you would have never guessed some of the hardships they went through.
Exactly.
So it was definitely a tool to create a very unique sense of community. Very, very instantly. Perhaps maybe that's Facebook's role, is like you can do it to everybody at the same time and hear back immediately.
Right. And it did bring people sort of, you know, obviously that's what I hope the book will do. People identified with it, and so they were able to open up to me about similar things that are not similar, but, you know, heartbreak in its many different forms. People opened up to me about that, and it helped me. And I think it helped them, but it also really helped me a lot at that time in my life.
And I love that you didn't just stop there. Inspired by a friend who said, oh, you know, after all these offers and invitations, they said, oh, you should do a comfort food journey. And you didn't just, you know, leave it at there. You took this in real life and went and visited, reconnected with people in this community that was no longer just a virtual community. So this is...
That was my friend Eileen.
And how long did that take, this whole comfort food travels? Or is it still going on? I'm curious.
Well, it didn't happen right away. I mean, you read the book, so you know that before I could, you know, go on this merry little tour connecting with all my friends and eating delicious food, I fell apart, you know, a couple of times.
Yeah.
But at the same time, you know, and I was thinking about this recently, a lot of what happens in the book took place when I was still pretty lost. I mean, you know, I know a lot of books that have sort of a device like this, you know, they give themselves, you know, 365 days. I visited people, I started visiting people before I even had the idea, you know, had a book contract. And then, though, while I was writing, once I started writing, which started about a year after the bad incident, then I kept visiting people because I found that, you know, my life started changing and writing itself into the book in really good and bad ways. And so it continued. The last chapter of the book, which is when I'm working in a lodge in North Carolina, that was a full 2.5 years later.
So this is writing, in real time and totally organic.
Yeah, I skip over stuff, but yeah. I mean, there are some things that happened, you know, it's, what is it, 2017, in the last 5 years, 5.5 years, that are in there in, you know, in a way, but not as far as chronologically, you know. My life has changed a lot. I'm a completely different person in a lot of ways.
Wow. So, but everything is so fresh as you're writing it. It's you know, it's happening as you write. And without that, you know, that, I guess, the reflection or, like, the, what is it called? The distance, I guess, of looking back on another time. I think it's really interesting to read a writer who is going through everything in real time and maybe finding comfort. Was it sort of therapeutic to write too? I mean, diaries is in the title.
Absolutely.
So.
Yeah, absolutely. I, you know, in fact, I remember the first real trip that I took to go visit my cousin Tony in Atlanta. I had a notebook with me all the time. And when I was living with my aunt, Ron, Uncle John in Gaylord, Virginia, I had a notebook all the time. And in Cortland, when we went to visit the peanut maker. And, you know, that used to be a distraction for people around me as a reporter when I was writing about restaurants or when I was doing, you know, processed teas. But it started to become such second nature for me just to be writing everything down that, you know, it did become therapeutic. It was like writing in a diary, which I've never done, by the way. I've never kept a diary in my life.
Well, I think it's so refreshing to read this and learn about more of, like, the mechanics of how you wrote this. It's what I kind of thought when I was reading this, but I'm glad to hear. It's definitely a very different read.
I'm glad it has that. Well, I really did want it to be natural. And the recipes that I picked, you know, at first I thought, well, I should make the recipes, you know, more organic. But what I ended up deciding to do was really include the recipes for the food that I ate during this period. It's not necessarily the food that I'm eating now. It's a real reflection of this slice of my life. I guess that's a food word. But, I tried to be as natural about it as I could. I didn't read food memoirs. Mostly I read cookbooks. I've got a lot of reading to catch up on, including newspapers. But I find cookbooks really comforting. I like to take them to bed, and I love old cookbooks. So that kind of informed how it turned out, too, a little bit.
I love how you can read about one moment you're meditating on bitterness, and then there's a recipe for a bitter salad with grapefruit and avocado and so forth, you know, peppered throughout
this. One of my favorite salads.
That sounds awesome right now. There's so
it's
many
a really good salad.
Yeah. Yeah. But, you know, it really ties in neatly and naturally, and that it's not even the end of the chapter. It just goes on with the rest of the text or of the chapter right after a recipe. I thought that was a fun twist. I haven't seen that before. We have so many themes to discuss in this book, but I want to cut to a quick little commercial interlude and we'll be right back.
Okay. All right.
This episode is brought to you by Castor and Pollux, maker of America's number one organic pet food, Organix. You put a lot of care and thought into what you eat. After all, you're a food radio listener. That thoughtfulness goes hand in paw with how you feed your pets. Purposeful pet food doesn't happen by accident. Castor and Pollux scours the earth to carefully select the best organic and responsibly sourced ingredients. New Pristine from Castor and Pollux is the only complete line of pet food made with ingredients that are responsibly raised, caught, or grown. Feed your dog or cat the new standard, like grass-fed beef, wild-caught fish, and vegetables grown without synthetic fertilizers or chemical pesticides. Pristine from Castor and Pollux. Purposeful pet food. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org/pets.
All right, we're back chatting more with Emily Nunn, whose new book, The Comfort Food Diaries, comes out this Tuesday. Emily, you still there?
I'm still here.
All right, thanks again. So we were talking about the sort of setup for this whole memoir, the journey that you go on. And you drop a lot of interesting thoughts about cooking and its purposes in life. And I think it's really... I think it's really interesting how many uses there are for cooking. I mean, you're clearly throughout just a diehard home cook. I think in your bio right. It says you're a home cooking evangelist.
Right. I believe in it.
Mm-hmm. And so you're writing also about, you know, this book deals with addiction and recovery. So
right.
I think it's interesting that you only notice, it sounds like, when you're at the rehab at the Betty Ford Center, you write that, you know, you're all alone, so there's nobody to cook for. Your fiance and his child, there are no longer people to cook for.
Right.
And that's when you realize that you use cooking as a way to show love or maybe try to seek love.
Right.
And that's when it dawned on you because you're all alone.
Right. Yeah, because, I mean, at that point in my life, I mean, this didn't last, but I was out in the desert. You know, Betty Ford is out in Rancho Mirage, and I was in a desert town not far from there. And I was by myself in this strange landscape, and my loneliness, you know, it wasn't a painful loneliness. Mm-hmm. I needed it, but not cooking. I noticed that I wasn't cooking for myself. I mean, I'm eating at the salad bar at Betty Ford, which was delicious. And I was struck by that. I was going out and getting grapefruits and oranges, which I love. So I was feeding myself. I never stopped eating, but I wasn't doing that thing that to me is super elemental, which is making a meal and planning a menu. Mm-hmm. And I love to go to the grocery store. And so I was really struck by the fact that, you know, and this is going to sound so corny, but that I wasn't loving myself, you know? Mm-hmm. I was basically, you know, having a fight with myself. I was mad at myself. And so while, you know, comfort food, you know, per se can be comforting, you know, its opposite is, you know, it's pretty bleak.
Right.
I mean, it's not like I wasn't eating at all. I always like a little something. No matter
yeah,
how
it seems like
I
you're always very
but
attentive to what you're eating.
When I was still in Chicago, even though I wasn't, you know, that was a very uncomfortable situation, I was still cooking.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I was still making food for everybody and a lot, and it made me feel better.
Right.
So
it's amazing, actually. It sounds like you were a very advanced level cook for your family at the time. But one thing I think is really interesting to note, you know, we hear a lot about people cooking for their family or for their children. But mm-hmm. one thing I think is really underrated, which came to me reading your book, is the joys and the benefits and just wonderfulness of cooking for others who are old friends or family
right.
members who are not part of your immediate family.
Right.
Like, why don't we do
and
that more often?
I don't know. And it's, you know, it's a funny thing. I mean, I would so much rather cook with people. This has taught me from cooking when I'm by myself, which I've been a lot lately, but there's just something, you know, if you're at the least bit stumped about how to show your affectionate for, you know, your affection for someone, make them a sandwich, you know? I mean, and I consider a lot of different things cooking, you know,
mm-hmm.
boiling some, you don't have to be a master chef. I mean, boiling some
meal
shrimp
providing.
And then
yeah.
buying a lot of cocktail sauce and, you know,
sure.
but doing it for someone else is, you know, it's again, really corny, but it's a separate language.
It is.
You don't have to feel corny. Nobody ever rejects food. You know, you don't get rejected.
But, I think that is the fear. Is people
love.
Every time I hear people's, you know, who don't like to cook, it's for others, especially. It's just like, oh, they're afraid of being judged. They're afraid they're not good enough at cooking.
Right.
But, you know, as you mentioned, you could just thaw some shrimp and put out some cocktail sauce. So.
Yeah. I mean, there's a saying, you know, I don't remember where it came from, but, you know, in my book, the best damn sandwich is the one that someone else makes for you.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I make great sandwiches, but if you make me a BLT, you know, I'll follow you around for the rest of your life.
Mm-hmm.
Your BLT is somehow better than mine, and it's because you made it for me. It's that simple.
Yeah, you came up with something that I wouldn't have because you're you.
Yep.
I love that. That's explored throughout this book, and you know, getting to know people on that other level, through food, whether or not that person is even a foodie, or you know,
is
a great lesson to take away from this book.
Yep.
The other is just the idea of like reconnecting with so many people. Throughout the life that, you know, was helping to bring you back to where you are. So I think that it's an amazing and brave journey. Now, did you, reading throughout all these visits and, you know, travels that you took, did you sort of plot out a course, or did you just let yourself be guided organically once you decided to write a book about this?
Well, it was a little bit of both. In fact, you know, I had this bag that I carried around at Betty Ford, and when I actually realized, okay, I really do need to do this. I need to go make these trips and make this a real project. And it was partly out of necessity, too. I mean, I really didn't have any place to go. So I found this list of people that I wanted to visit and people who ended up in the book, and I have friends who got cut just because the book got big and rambling.
Yeah, I was wondering how that works.
Yeah, people got cut, and chefs got cut, and but it was a little bit of both. I mean, there's a lot of stuff that just unfolded naturally, and since I was taking notes constantly and taking photographs, because I take tons of pictures wherever I go, I kind of had to cull and make the book around it. Mm-hmm. The short answer is both of those things. I plotted it a little, and then I also let it happen.
So, of course, in the title, The Comfort Food Diaries, what is the meaning of comfort food to you? Well, like, is there any such thing as the perfect comfort food?
Well, someone asked me that the other day, and, you know, my final takeaway from this book is that comfort food, whatever you decide, and especially for women, it should not be something that you have to eat in the closet. It should never make you feel ashamed. If you're going to eat cupcakes in the closet, pick another comfort food.
Yeah.
Because, you know, I did a lot of research about comfort food, believe it or not, while I was doing the book, and there were these studies that said that women tended to eat junk food, M&Ms and pretzels, and men always want a casserole. And I remember thinking, well, of course, because women feel this stress about feeding their family. So a casserole is like, oh, my God, am I going to be able to get it done by 5? So, you know, if you really do want to eat 2 cartons of Ben and Jerry's, do it and feel proud of it. But otherwise, you really have to find that thing that rings your chime. It shouldn't be something that makes you feel ashamed.
Right. Or
that's my final
So many meanings to that, like the private comfort food that is guilt-inducing.
Right.
Where, how did eating get to that place, you know, when it's supposed to be?
And it sure has, especially in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, it just reminds me, and this is not necessarily always true. I mean, many, many years ago, like 3 fiancés ago, I had a breakup, and the man left, and I got donuts, and so I...
Hey, that's comforting.
I can eat donuts now. Yeah. They make me sick, because, you know, sugar, fried, refined flour. I mean, I love them. I'll take a bite, but I started eating donuts, and I started crying, because, you know, I was sad, and then I started crying because I was eating donuts alone, and then that made me start laughing, because I was eating donuts alone and crying, and so it kind of turned from, you know, bad comfort food into good comfort food, because it made me make fun of myself for being so melodramatic, you know?
Right, right. Like, we're always thinking somebody's looking at us, too, when we eat these things, when really, actually, just, own it.
Right. And if you want to make a casserole and it makes you stressed out, you know, then do go and get a Stouffer's lasagna if that's what makes you feel good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know?
I hope that a lot of people will be a lot more or a lot less hindered when it comes to cooking and also just enjoying food after reading this really, really remarkable book.
Thank you.
I continue learning so many just like little insights throughout from this book. So unfortunately, though, that's about all the time we have for today. But I can't thank you enough for joining us to discuss.
Oh, Kathy, thank you for having me.
Yeah. And so Comfort Food Diaries comes out this Tuesday from Atria Books. And it's a triumphant story, I should say. I know we talked a lot about, you know, the kind of dark details, but it is truly a wonderful journey with a happy ending. So.
Oh, thank you so much.
As
I really appreciate it, Gabby.
Yeah, and thank you so much again. And thanks, everyone at Heritage. We'll see you next week on Eat Your Words.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening. That I ain't never, 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 never had no loving like this before.